books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we're having a look back at some of the best of the fests. When I was allowed out of the studio and allowed to go to a book festival. So today, coming up, we have got Dom Jolly, Louise Minchin, Wayne Sleep, Andrew O'Hagan, and we'll start with Rupert Everett. Hollywood actor and writer Rupert Everett has spent his life surrounded by extraordinary people and witnessed extraordinary events. He was in Moscow during the fall of communism, in Berlin the night the wall came down, and as we'll hear, in downtown Manhattan on 9/11. His memoir, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins, swoops from the lifestyle of the British upper classes to the madness of Hollywood. It's available abridged commercially, read by Rupert, and unabridged from RNIB Library, as read by Greg Wagland, and we'll hear from it later on. Rupert was at the Boswell Book Festival, though, to talk about his new book, The American No, which he narrates along with Alan Cordoner and Freddie Fox. It's a collection of stories taking us on an exhilarating journey with a cast of extraordinary characters.
I was sitting outside Bar Italia on Frith Street one afternoon last November. That ship of fools has been my home from home from home since I first moved to Soho in 1988. Sitting there, drifting, wrapped up against the drizzle like a pot in a tea cosy, was a singular experience verging on bliss. Surveying the street from this old bird's eye view, the straight Georgian lines of its brick flanks merging on Soho Square, was like looking at a negative or a double exposure, because the black faces of ghosts seemed to stare through the walls, memories hidden in doorways lit suddenly by the long-forgotten flare of a match. With a wink of the mind's eye, the focus was pulled to the distant past, while the present moment bent and blurred in the patter of rain. In the old days, I had breakfast every day at Bar Italia, lunched next door at Little Italy, conducted my business meetings, my promotional endeavours, and my love affairs on the strip of pavement between the two establishments. Most of my friends lived within walking distance. Alan, Julia, Bailey and John. Occasionally I acted in a play and tottered back and forth to the theatre. I rarely left Soho, perhaps to meet the old Chelsea crowd from before the war, but I always ran back as soon as I could. Once you had lived in that strange corner, nothing else would ever do.
Rupert Everett reading from his book The American No. At the Boswell Book Festival, I asked him, what is an American No?
An American No in show business is when you go for a meeting to pitch an idea to a studio or a group of executives, and the meeting goes incredibly well and everyone says they love you and they want to work with you, they can't wait for it all to begin, and you leave the meeting walking on air, you buy a new car, you redecorate your house, and then you never hear from any of them ever again. And that's called The American No.
So your book is a collection of stories that, were they rejected or were they things that you've pitched before?
One of them only ever got made. Most of them were just rejected.
On an ordinary evening, I would leave my room at the hotel, ring the bell of Alan's flat, collect him, pass by Princess Julia's, and then go on to Bailey and John's on Charing Cross Road. But this was all 30 years ago now, all gone. Like tears in the rain. Alan killed himself, Julia moved east, John lives in Italy. Only Bailey remains. Apart from him, Soho is another country. Briefly, we queens achieved supremacy, but we were moved on with the hookers and the homeless at around the time of Paul Raymond's death. I too had some kind of ascendancy. Traffic stopped when I crossed Old Compton Street. Well, not exactly, but you know what I mean. Today, I'm just another old oddity, with scowling lips haunting the streets, walked through, another ghost as I crossed the road at Cambridge Circus. Occasionally some medium from the old days sees one and screams. Sometimes greetings are exchanged, sometimes not. Often things are better left behind. The only group to survive, rain or shine, it seems, are the Hare Krishnas, and here they come now in the headlights and the spitting rain, turning the corner out of Soho Square, quite a big group today, clashing their cymbals and singing their songs, transcendental Morris dancers weaving around to the beat of their little drum, fully made up, pink and apricot, saris and dhotis, sandals and trainers. Some have backpacks crammed with their day drag. I used to find them annoying, but today, looming through the gathering dusk, they're enchanting, strange, a caravan of wonderful freaks crossing the asphalt desert. They arrived from a fairy kingdom with their cymbals, their drums. Someone had a portable sound system and his voice rang out, amplified and bounced across the street, urging the others on. Hare, hare, they sang back. Unlike myself, they still stopped traffic. People still looked out of windows or stood and gaped.
Now, the audio version of the book is narrated by yourself and two other narrators. Were you involved in the casting of the other people?
I was. I didn't read it all myself because it's a very, very difficult thing to do, to read a whole book. And I liked very much these two actors, Freddie Fox and Alan Corduna, who read the other parts. And so it seemed like a good idea.
Now, I was here a couple of years ago with Lady Anne Glenconner, and she told me you tried to talk her out of narrating her own book.
Oh, did I? But did she narrate her own book?
She did in the end. Yeah.
Well, and she probably enjoyed it too, because she's loved everything to do with her book. I just find it, you need, it's not as easy as it seems, just sitting in a room talking to the microphone. Mm. It's definitely an art, but one she probably has. I never listened to her audio because I read the book.
That's what I was going to ask. Sort of, you're used to acting on screen and stage. Is it hard to pour that performance into the microphone?
No, it's not that. It's that you're sitting there with the page and it just seems endless. And after a certain moment, you kind of lose the will to live, if you're me. And then you kind of get depressed and you think, oh, this is so bad. And then you kind of spiral. That's what I find. And you do definitely need a kind of performance intensity and energy to get you through. And it's difficult, isn't it? None of these things are that easy.
Now your book is available in audio. It's accessible to anyone for whatever reason. Dyslexia, sight loss, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Very important, because it means it opens it up to people who are visually impaired. It opens it up to people who go on long journeys in cars. Lots of great things happen. It's difficult because it's not the same, and normally you don't get to hear the whole of someone's book. It's edited. And that's another reason why it's horrible doing your own audio, because you read it and you think, why did they edit this bit? And that was my best bit. And that can be difficult too. No, I think it's great doing audios.
As I mentioned earlier, Rupert's memoir, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins, is available from RNIB unabridged, as read by Greg Wagland.
Look at the World Trade Center. Looking up is one of the great sensations in New York. There is mayhem all around you, but up there is silence and space, and the tips of the high towers commune with the heavens like eyelashes brushing against a lover's cheek. And in that glance from the street to the skyscraper lies the whole American dream. There was a hole in the North Tower, like a tear. Were they making a movie? Then there was a bang like Concorde breaking the speed of sound. You felt it slightly in your body and your ears popped. The second plane crashed into the South Tower, and we watched in speechless wonder as glass and metal began to fall from the towers in glittering shards that caught the sun. They were like two fireworks about to go off. People stood in the streets looking up. Cars stopped and passengers got out. Some people still scurried about their day until somebody nudged them, and they too looked up and froze. I never saw so many vacant faces.
I'm just going to address a strange coincidence, because I interviewed Martin Jarvis here a few years ago, mm-hmm. who happened to be in Manhattan during 9/11, mm-hmm. as were you, mm-hmm. as documented in your book.
Yeah, 9/11 was an amazing event to have witnessed. I was in my house as the first plane happened, and I was trying to do some Buddhist chants, and I was chanting, chanting, and these all these ambulances kept going, and I went, and I had to stop my meditation, but it was because they were all going down to the World Trade Center.
The wailing was for later. For now, it was like the end of the world in a movie, when the spaceships hover over Manhattan. Hollywood had out-tricked us, and at first it wasn't possible to take it all in. Everything one saw that day was lifted from a movie, every cop, every scream, every plummeting body. And of course the ultimate special effect, the two towers consuming themselves and crashing to the ground. We'd seen it all before in countless movies, and movies were all we had left in that September of 2001. They were real. Actual life was swept under the carpet and ignored. One half expected to see Bruce Willis appearing out of the rubble, holding the movie's unconscious babe in his arms. Then someone would shout, "Cut!" and we could move on.
And how have you found Dumfries House and Boswell so far?
Very exciting. The trees outside were, first of all, incredible. And I just had a little look around the house. It's beautiful, incredible. And it's one of the, I mean, how spoiled is one to be able to come up here and see this place, stay in the nice hotel? It's gorgeous.
It was only later, when that hard, angry city turned for once into a fountain of compassion, that one was foolish enough to believe that the day's events could be the kernel for a quantum leap towards world peace. Anyone would help you that day, absolutely anyone. It wasn't just a disco song, a Motown myth. Love was finally in the air. Maybe we could stop in its name. But the powers that be wanted to go on with the movie version, and the rest is history.
Rupert Everett's book Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins and Vanished Years are available from RNIB Library in audio, and The American Novel is available in print as an e-book and in audio commercially.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
At the Wigtown Book Festival, I chatted to Louise Minchin about her first fiction book, Isolation Island. Louise went from presenting BBC Breakfast to competing for the GB team in triathlon in World and European Championships, a journey she charted in her first book, Dare to Try. In Fearless, she sets out to push herself even further, alongside trailblazing women who are breaking down barriers, smashing records, and challenging stereotypes. In every chapter, Louise goes on an adventure with a different woman to tell their story and to test herself. She narrates the audio version herself.
Are you okay? No, I'm not. I've had enough. I cannot interview yet another man about his adventures. What about all the women doing incredible things? The fearless females? Why don't we talk to them? Why aren't they on the sofa being interviewed? Why don't we hear their stories? That was the moment for me, the moment I decided to write this book. I was fed up of being complicit with the narrative that it is only men who deserve to be celebrated, only men who are brave, only men who stretch the limits of what is humanly possible. I was done with telling only one side. Why? Because being talked about and being seen matters. If you don't hear it and you don't see it, how can you be it? We need equal representation. I had to write this as a journalist, as an endurance athlete, and as a mother to two daughters because, with respect to all the men I've interviewed, women and girls need heroes too. Heroes who look like them. And by the way, I'd argue that men like to hear the stories of heroic women too. I had already fought and won some important battles for equality during my TV career, including a bruising and long-winded fight to get paid the same as my male co-presenters sitting next to me. The other battle was to make sure that women presenting BBC Breakfast were allowed occasionally to lead the programme. I had noticed that almost every day my male colleague was given the prestigious task of saying hello at the top of each hour, introducing the programme, doing the first interview. Once I had noticed how often it happened, I couldn't unsee it. Why was it happening? Why was I always the second person to speak, even though I was older and more experienced? What message did it send to all our female viewers? That I wasn't as important as my male counterpart? That I was second fiddle? That I didn't deserve to be there? What implication did that have for their own lives and their own careers? I thought it was unfair, unequal, and also immensely damaging.
Louise Minchin, reading from her book, Fearless. As we'll find out, her appearance in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here gave her the idea for her first fiction book, Isolation Island, which is narrated by Daphne Kuma.
Perched precariously above a jagged, geometric tumble of high cliffs is the forbidding silhouette of the monastery, etched against the sky. A tall circular watchtower dominates the scene, like an exclamation mark, a stark warning to anyone who approaches that they are being observed at all times. It dwarfs the belfry, which still stands defiant next to the derelict remains of the chapel, destroyed in a fire decades ago. Here and there the walls are pulled apart entirely, torn down by merciless gales that have sent masonry smashing into pieces on the rocks below. Everything about it is foreboding, a place to scare you away, not welcome you in. In Lauren's endless hours researching the history and geography of Aelin Manach, nothing has prepared her for the starkness of its wind-torn reality.
Isolation Island is about 10 celebrities who are going to go to an isolated island off the northwest coast of Scotland to take part in the toughest of tough reality shows. Think I'm a Celebrity with Traitors and Agatha Christie and Then There Were None, all of those put together. And there is a storm on the way, a once in a 100-year storm. And you may be able to guess, they are going to get cut off from everybody. They're going to be all on their own in this derelict monastery, and things are going to go badly wrong for them. It's a thriller. Someone will die.
As she takes in her new home, the boat steadies. It has entered the lee of the island, and the sea is no longer choppy. The rolling waves have dispersed. For the first time, Lauren begins to take serious notice of her fellow passengers. She needs to start thinking of them as contestants, competitors, not just a ragtag bunch of semi-famous faces. All of them are in motion, talking feverishly amongst themselves. Beside her, Max straightens from his crouch at last. She watches him as his eyes fix on the monastery. For a moment, his face holds a curious blankness. No fear, no excitement, no enthusiasm. It is as though he's looking inward, not outwards at the forbidding sight ahead. Then he blinks and becomes the brash, hearty sportsman she has seen in so many interviews and on numerous quiz shows.
Jesus, would you look at that, he says. I don't reckon it's going to be a five-star stay. By the state of the place, my money is on some of us not even surviving a couple of days.
Is it based on your experience, well, not in the jungle, I was going to say, but in I'm a Celebrity in the Welsh castle when a storm hit?
It's exactly inspired by the moment when I was on I'm a Celebrity back in 2021 in a castle in North Wales, and this once in a 100-year storm came and took the programme off air. It ripped off the roofs of all the production teams, caravans or wherever they work in studios, and trees came down and lashing rain, and the programme was taken off air. And when I left, I was put in a taxi in the middle of the night, in the dark and the lashing rain, going to, I didn't know where and I didn't know how long for. And I just thought, I have got the most brilliant location for Thriller, a reality TV show that goes spectacularly wrong.
You have 10 minutes to put on your habits and place everything you came with into the large sack with your name on and hands it over. Put everything in. Anyone who doesn't obey to the letter comes back with me to the mainland. Game over, no discussion.
Despite bubbling groans of complaint,
Everyone does what he says. As quickly as they can, and hopping comically from one foot to another, they start to pull off their damp clothes and strip down to their matching dark blue thermals, which they had been told to wear under their other clothes. It is hardest for the kayakers, who are inhibited by their tight-fitting dry suits, and there is a moment of hilarity when Nico and Jackson try to assist Frank, who is struggling to get his legs out of the rubberized cuffs. They pull at his arms so hard that he loses his balance, topples backwards, and lands sprawled on the sand, laughing along with the rest as Matt gives him a hand up and a pat on the back. 10 minutes later, they are all transformed. 10 brown figures, all dressed exactly the same in matching hooded monk's habits, stripped of the trappings that marked out their individuality. As they stuff their own clothes back into their sacks, the air is full of laughter and good-natured mockery.
Never played a monk before. This could be a right laugh.
And there's an obvious love of Agatha Christie in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tried not to read or go anywhere near And Then There Were None when I was writing it, because I just thought, I don't want to be any more influenced than I am already. And then shortly after finishing the second draft, or maybe last draft, I listened to And There Were None, and I could not believe how much that book is literally in our DNA. There were so many things. So it's a very similar, dark, malevolent place, my island, and also the one there. So yeah, absolutely inspired by that.
Now, we have your books, Fearless and Dare to Try, in the RNIB Library, narrated by you. But for this one, you handed it over to Drafty Kuma. Why did you decide not to narrate this one?
I wasn't invited to read this one. I had to audition to read Dare to Try and Fearless, which luckily I passed the auditions, given that I used to read out loud for an actual living. I was pleased with that. And I'd written those books myself. But this one needed an actor, because there are 10 different characters and I couldn't do the voices. So, but you know what? Next time I might be really tempted to do it, because it's so interesting, isn't it? Because I listen to them all the time, by the way. And they, you know, they really change your judgment of a character in so many ways. So next time I might try and give it a go. But she's done a great job. She's brilliant as Lauren, who's my main character, who's an investigative journalist. And thank you, Daphne, for doing such a great job.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from an online source is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Oh, yes. So the cover, I absolutely love the cover and had quite a lot of discussions about the cover. So on the cover, you've got the derelict monastery, and the belfry is really important in Isolation Island. So you've got that right heart and centre of this island, and it's a tiny island. It'll take you maybe half an hour to walk around it. So you've got this tiny island, you've got the trees on the island, you've got a brilliant kind of quite threatening though sunset in the back, because we know it kind of gives you an idea that there is a storm either coming or has been there. And also the water, which is dark and blue and has these kind of bubbles, and the water takes up about half of the cover. Isolation is above the water, island is below the water, and I love it because it absolutely says what it does on the tin. You know you're going to get a dark story, you're probably going to be chilled by it, and it's definitely slightly scary cover, but in a really good way.
What about my sunglasses? They cost me a fortune! Nico is showing every sign of having a meltdown until they realise that Taisy's perfect face has crumpled into real, distressed tears. Holly reaches out to pull her into a hug. My photo! Holly, that's my photo in there. I know you said not to bring it in case it got lost, but I just needed it near me, and now it's gone. Holly strokes Taisy's hair and looks up at the row of puzzled faces. It's a picture of her mum. She died not long ago. A distant memory stirs in Lauren, her niece telling her how distraught she and all Taisy's fans were for her when she revealed her loss. A murmur of sympathy goes up and Holly speaks louder into Taisy's ear. Taisy, come on now, it's fine. You know you've got copies of that photo, it's your screensaver. And then, a little more sharply, Taisy, don't do this. It's fine. You are going to be fine. Taisy sniffs and her face emerges from Holly's shoulder. She gulps a few times, then gives a weak smile. Sorry. So sorry. That was just silly of me. I just wanted to feel like she was here with me.
Sorry, Halls, you were right. The others cluster for a group hug. The cynical side of Lauren wonders how much of their display is genuine empathy and how much is for the watching cameras. But there's no doubt Taisie looks more cheerful when she emerges. The metallic double cough of a motor starting breaks them apart. Without a final word, the captain has returned to the rib and is readying it for the return journey.
Daphne Kuma reading Isolation Island by Louise Minchin, which is available in print as an ebook and in audio commercially. Louise's non-fiction books, Dare to Try and Fearless, are both available from RNIB Talking Books. Legendary ballet dancer Wayne Sleep was at the Boswell Book Festival, looking back on the extraordinary times he's lived through. He has danced with ballet legends Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn, partied with Freddie Mercury and performed on the Covent Garden stage in 1985 with Princess Diana, becoming her close friend. Nanette de Valois, founder of the Royal Ballet, described him as the greatest virtuoso dancer the Royal Ballet has ever produced. Wayne was also the shortest principal dancer in the Royal Ballet, and as such, he had to spin twice as fast and jump twice as high to succeed. However, behind the glitz and glamour, Wayne has always felt like an outsider, revealing in Just Different the difficulties experienced by a working-class gay man in handling the prejudices of his generation and living through the AIDS epidemic. In this moving but also laugh-out-loud and gossip-filled memoir, Wayne Sleep shows how he danced his way to success, fulfilment and love, overcoming obstacles along the way.
I performed my first ever pirouette in the womb. As my mother's due date approached in the summer of 1948, the midwife discovered I was lying in a breech position and had to deftly spin me around with forceps to prevent me emerging backside first. It wasn't the only pregnancy-related complication my mum had to endure, bless her. The location of my spine had triggered agonising nerve pain throughout her body, the shock of which had caused her thick, wavy brown hair to fall out in clumps. Following a traumatic birth, I cried constantly for 6 weeks and refused to take my mother's milk. My auntie Vera had to express hers instead, which I much preferred for some reason. And on top of that, I was born with a severe squint. "Is he cross-eyed, June?" neighbours would tactlessly ask Mum as they peered into my pram. Fortunately, in time, that rectified itself. When I wrote a book called Just Different, and why I called it Just Different, because I was too small to get in the Royal Ballet. You have to be 5'9". I was only 5'2". And the depression of training for 8 years and winning scholarships to the Royal Ballet School and all that, and I was coming first in everything. And to think that then, because of my height, I was distraught. But I talk about tackling that. Now, I did get into the Royal Ballet and became a senior principal. And also, in the 60s, being gay when it was against the law, and the publishers were very keen on a report about somebody who actually lived through all that period, and having such friends as Freddie Mercury, who's one of my best friends, David Hockney, the painter. In fact, he's just done a big exhibition at the Louis Vuitton Gallery in Paris, and he's exhibited a room for me where I have a film that makes people look all like Cubist pictures, all that's in it. And knowing Diana so well and dancing with her on stage, how that came about. So I have stories about very famous people and a lot more than that. And also touring America with the Royal Ballet, with Margot Fonteyn, Rudolf Nureyev, and my mother's relationship to me when I was illegitimate and how she could have had a career but didn't and suffered because of me but loved us. And that's about it, really. I mean, it can go on forever. But the book doesn't, so you should enjoy it. "So very kind of you to invite me for lunch, Wayne," said Diana, Princess of Wales, while reclining into my living room sofa and kicking off her shoes. As her slim, elegant feet sank into my cheap, short-pile carpet, the same feet that 3 years previously had memorably stepped in sync with mine at the Royal Opera House, I cringed inside, wishing I'd splashed out on that Persian rug from Harrods after all. Finding my South Kensington home had been incredibly fortuitous. Since creating my own touring production, Dash, I'd yearned to set up my own dance studio, and sure enough, had found a place that ticked all the right boxes. Originally built as stables in Victorian times, it had subsequently been converted into a formal ballroom before becoming a dance school. It was rare in those days to find such a big space with no pillars. Then, not long after, I bought the studio. The Muse property opposite came on the market, which I immediately snapped up, even though it meant selling my beloved apartment in Covent Garden. Having my house and my studio within yards of each other was just perfect. Both spaces needed tons of work and a very accommodating bank manager, but I reckoned it was worth it. Nanette Devawa, who founded the Royal Ballet, she was my director at the school and in the company at one point, and I was going to take hormones to make myself grow, but they weren't advanced very much. They weren't scientifically proven, so anything could have happened. And she said, "You're not to." She said, "You're just to jump twice as high as everybody else and spin twice as fast." So that's what got me in the company. And all the choreographers were there, and they choreographed roles specially for me. So I was being given my own repertoire, and it was being created on me. So that's what made me stay. But then I branched out, and Andrew Lloyd Webber asked me to dinner one night, and he said, "Let's get round the piano." And I thought, this isn't dinner, this is an audition. His wife came running in saying, "I didn't know you sing." And I thought, neither did I. And I created the part of Mr. Mistopheles in Cats, so it shows you how we got through the rehearsals of that. Then I did a film with Sean Connery and another film, and I was offered a contract in with Columbia in Los Angeles, and I just thought, which one should I do? Should I stay with the ballet? But I stayed with the ballet because I trained for that for 8 years, and I couldn't suddenly let it go. And I'd fought to stay there, so I couldn't leave it at that point.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
This whole business of Talking Books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. After Trigger Happy TV, Dom Jolly started writing travel books with a twist. He went monster hunting in his book Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. He went on the Downhill Hiking Club, and recently he set off once again, immersing himself in the strange world of conspiracies. Conspiracy theories used to be fun, a bit of a laugh. Did we really land on the moon? Was Paul McCartney cloned? Nowadays, however, in the aftermath of Donald Trump, a global pandemic and the ever-increasing influence of social media algorithms, they are part of the body politic and a massive cause of division and mistrust. In The Conspiracy Tourist, Dom Jolly sets out on a global journey to find out what's going on. His travels see him meeting followers of QAnon, hunting for UFOs in Roswell, chasing Alex Jones of InfoWars around Austin, trying to prove that Finland exists, and taking a flat earther to the edge of the world. On the way, Dom inevitably finds the funny, but he also tries to understand what makes people so drawn to conspiracy theories. What if those he has long dismissed as crazed loonies actually have a point? The Conspiracy Tourist is written and read by Dom Jolly.
I'd written a book, Scary Monsters, in which I travelled the world in search of mythical beasts, such as the Yeti and Bigfoot, less as a believer and more as a curious observer. I'd also touched upon conspiracies in my book, The Dark Tourist, when, as part of my American assassination vacation, I'd visited Dallas. Back in 2008, as I wandered around Dealey Plaza, I came to a walkway just below the infamous Grassy Knoll, where a veritable mini-market of conspiracy theorists had set up stalls peddling books and videos that championed their various theories. Kennedy had been killed by the mob, the Russians, the Cubans, Marilyn Monroe, the Muppets. The thing that had struck me the most at the time was just how impossible it was to argue with them. They had all the facts at their fingertips. They were so certain of everything. I'd never really been certain of anything in my life except for my suspicion of people who were certain of things. In his book, Suspicious Minds, Why We Believe Conspiracy Theories, Rob Brotherton, a psychology professor at Goldsmiths, wrote, "Conspiracy theories postulate a black and white world in which good is struggling against evil. The general public is cast as the victim of organized persecution, and the motives of the alleged conspirators often verge on pure maniacal evil. At the very least, the conspirators are said to have an almost inhuman disregard for the basic liberty and well-being of the general population. More grandiose conspiracy theories portray the conspirators as being evil incarnate, of having caused all the ills from which we suffer, committing abominable acts of unthinkable cruelty on a routine basis, and striving ultimately to subvert or destroy everything we hold dear."
I am here with a book called The Conspiracy Tourist, in which I've travelled around the world hanging out with conspiracy theorists, mainly so you don't have to, and just seeing, yeah, what's going on. Conspiracies used to be fun, eccentric, and then there was a tipping point where they've kind of become a lot more serious and a lot more, I think, dangerous. So I just kind of wanted to do a travel book that incorporated conspiracies.
Do you think it's our connectivity these days, because every nutter in the pub can talk to every other nutter in every other pub?
I mean, you might say that. I couldn't possibly comment. There is a quote in the book, which is, in the old days every village had an idiot, but now they all went online. And I think that is the problem. And I think more of a problem is the internet doesn't allow for nuance. The internet likes to polarise people one place or the other. And once you've chosen your side, the algorithm then just feeds you, you know, nonsense, frankly. And I'd say the internet is a massive problem with conspiracies.
This was probably why I found it rather difficult to get on with conspiracy theorists. Despite being a recovering goth, I was generally a glass half full kind of guy. I like to see the good in most people. I decided that I needed to get back out there. I needed to go IRL. I needed to travel through this strange new world as a wide-eyed voyager, eager to take in all the sights. I was going more as an onlooker as opposed to a judge. There was very little point in making too many judgments. If I did, they would only be disputed by the very people I was going to meet on my travels. I would be accused of being part of the whole thing. I would be called a shill in the pay of the baddies. I only wish somebody could tell me who to invoice. There would undoubtedly be more questions than answers by the time I'd finished, but I didn't care. I wanted to travel to the edges of the flat earth. I wanted to drive across America looking for UFOs and secret tunnels. I wanted to meet QAnoners. I wanted to see if Finland really existed. I wanted to see it all. I was off on another set of adventures. I was a conspiracy tourist.
Does Finland exist?
I think it does. There is a conspiracy theory that Finland doesn't exist, so I flew with my wife to Finland thinking this will be pretty easy. I landed in Helsinki and thought, right, it does. But of course, this is the problem. I think it exists. Conspiracists would tell you that I didn't land in Finland, that I landed in either Sweden or Russia, and that all the 4 million people that make up Finland are crisis actors. This is the problem. I could honestly tell you right now, I believe Finland exists, but if I had to conclusively prove to you that Finland exists, I could probably get up to 99%. But there's 1% of doubt and wiggle room that conspiracists give you, and it's that 1% is the petri dish in which all conspiracies thrive.
Another angle to the Finland conspiracy theory was that the world elites knew about the Japanese-Russian plot. They just chose to maintain the illusion of its existence as a sort of idealized liberal society that other countries could aspire to. No real country, the theory went, could be so consistently idealistic, topping global leagues for healthcare, education, literacy, sexual equality, press freedom, and non-corruption. Finnish people, according to the conspiracy theorists, believed that they lived in Finland, but they actually lived in towns in Estonia, Russia, and Sweden. Visitors to Finland were flown to these areas and were just told that they were in Finland. Most people appeared to enjoy it for what it was, a joke or a parody of real conspiracy theories. A hardcore minority, however, did start to believe it. There is an internet adage called Poe's Law that originates from a comment left by a man called Nathan Poe on a Christian internet forum, which states that it is impossible to create a parody of extreme views so obviously exaggerated that it cannot be mistaken by some readers or viewers as a sincere expression of the parodied views. According to Jack, the Finland conspiracy is a perfect case study of that. 90% of people view it as a parody, but 10% genuinely believe it's something that needs proving or debunking. And so it was decided. I was going to travel to Finland and try to debunk the theory. And this was why I was sitting in Stansted Airport with my wife. It might serve me well on my other journeys. And who knew? Maybe it was true.
Was there ever a point where you found yourself perhaps too far down the rabbit hole?
No. I mean, it's weird because I'm a very contrary person. I'm a sort of pathetic rebel, and I really should be someone that should believe in a lot of conspiracies. And there are conspiracies, don't get me wrong. There are definitely people doing conspiratorial things and very bad things. But it's just most of these things are utter nonsense. And I don't blame anyone that has gone down those rabbit holes. I feel sorry for them because it's very easily done. The people I have an issue with are the grifters, people that know that this is nonsense but are making a lot of money out of it and making a lot of people very unhappy.
Now, in your second career as a travel writer, you have narrated all of the audio versions of all your books. Was that an important thing for you to do?
Yeah, it is. It's quite an odd one because, firstly, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and so does my wife. And the first thing we do when we're listening to it is like, oh, please let the narrator be okay. As an example, my favourite travel book of all time is Mark Twain, The Innocents Abroad. People don't think of Mark Twain as a travel writer, but he was a fantastic travel writer. And he wrote pretty much the first, I'd say, modern travel book, The Innocents Abroad. He goes on a cruise ship around the Mediterranean and basically takes the mickey out of everyone on the boat and where he goes. But I have to say, the narrator is so awful. It sounds like someone, and I'm really sorry if the narrator is listening, but it sounds like someone is trying to, it sounds like someone's in a sort of Victorian Amdram, and also they're recording it in a sort of, in a church, like the echoes are so bad. So I think it's really important that. So I've always thought, well, there's no way I'm going to let someone else read my books because I'm a performer and I wanted to do it. The only problem is when I write, especially travel books, I write a lot of dialogue. And then, of course, I get to it and I realise I've written a lot of foreign accents and I have to do them. And A, I'm terrible at accents, but secondly, I'm thinking, is this racist? I'm not sure it is. So it's a big problem for me with that.
Now it is available in audio. It's accessible to anyone, for whatever reason, be it sight loss, dyslexia, doesn't have a relationship with print. Yeah. Is that important to you?
It is very important to me. And actually, I remember the first place I recorded the audio was in Camden for my first book. And that was where I think the RNIB do a lot of their...
So used to work.
Yeah, oh, really? So that's where I did my first one. And actually, that was the first time, because again, I was probably a bit, sorry to say this, blind to the situation. I didn't realise, this was before podcasts, actually, really, and I didn't realise how important, of course, audiobooks and stuff are to people that have lost the ability to read for whatever reason. So yeah, it's amazing. And I get so many people that are so, like, get extra out of the stuff that the author writes when he's reading it himself, I think, maybe. So, yeah, no, it's massively important.
The stewardess walked past, checking seatbelts. It was time for me to start the debunking. Excuse me, where's this plane going to? I asked. She looked at me strangely. Helsinki? In Finland, I continued. Yes, Finland. Is that not where you're supposed to be going? May I see your boarding pass? Yes, but I just wanted to make sure. So, Finland is definitely the country we're going to land in. The stewardess gave me a look that indicated she thought I might be trouble. Can I see your boarding pass, sir? I showed her my boarding pass, and she glanced at it before handing it back. Have a nice flight, sir. I shall. It'll be my first time in Finland. I pronounced the name of the country loudly and rather sarcastically so that if she was in on this, then she would know I was not fooled.
The Conspiracy Tourist by Dom Jolly is available both commercially and from R&IB Talking Books. And finally, let's hear from author Andrew O'Hagan for the books of his life.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I absolutely adored, when I was growing up, a lot of children's books. Fuss, you know, I was one of those kids who really, you know, learned how to think and how to express myself from reading, you know, books like The Little Prince or Charlotte's Web, The Railway Children, E. Nesbitt's fantastic Moving Story. These books gave me permission to feel and to express myself. You know, I couldn't believe the joy that those books brought me when I was very young. And I graduated from there to reading Dickens, a Robert Louis Stevenson, A Young Age, Treasure Island, Kidnapped, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. These Stevenson novels seemed like miracles to me, actually miraculous. You could send your mind and your heart into a strange, dark, but also strangely enlightening place. You came out the other end of this tunnel different. You were a different person. You were more fully formed. And I think that's what reading does for people. It gives them more of themselves and more of the world. So for me, oh, Stevenson. I mean, to this day, I can read a sentence of Stevenson's and I'm immediately transported back into this glittering world of the imagination.
The fire burned in the grate. A lamp was set lighted on the chimney shelf, for even in the houses the fog began to lie thickly. And there, close up to the warmth, sat Dr. Jekyll, looking deadly sick. He did not rise to meet his visitor, but held out a cold hand and bade him welcome in a changed voice. "And now," said Mr. Utterson, as soon as Poole had left them, "you have heard the news?" The doctor shuddered. "They were crying it in the square," he said. "I heard them in my dining room." "One word," said the lawyer. "Carew was my client, but so are you, and I want to know what I am doing. You have not been mad enough to hide this fellow." "Utterson, I swear to God," cried the doctor. "I swear to God I will never set eyes on him again. I bind my honour to you that I am done with him in this world. It is all at an end. And indeed, he does not want my help. You do not know him as I do. He is safe. He is quite safe. Mark my words. He will never more be heard of." The lawyer listened gloomily. He did not like his friend's feverish manner. "You seem pretty sure of him," said he. "And for your sake, I hope you may be right. If it came to a trial, your name might appear." "I am quite sure of him," replied Jekyll. "I have grounds for certainty that I cannot share with anyone. For there is one thing on which you may advise me. I have received a letter, and I am at a loss whether I should show it to the police. I should like to leave it in your hands, Utterson. You would judge wisely, I am sure. I have so great a trust in you." "You fear, I suppose, that it might lead to his detection?" asked the lawyer.
"No,"
said the other. "I cannot say that I care what becomes of Hyde. I am quite done with him. I was thinking of my own character, which this hateful business has rather exposed." Utterson ruminated a while. He was surprised at his friend's selfishness, and yet relieved by it. "Well," said he at last, "let me see the letter."
The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Other Tales of Terror by Robert Louis Stevenson.
is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Rory Kinnear.
Is there a book on a rainy day that you could curl up with and reread?
Bleak House by Charles Dickens is my rainy day book. I could read that book multiple times and never get bored, never think, oh, I know what's going to happen, it's all fine, you know, forget it. No. In some cases, I forget what's happened because I'm so involved in the moment-by-moment experience of the book. But even when I do know, I love the journey towards the revelation. Brilliant writing, brilliant humanity, amazing tolerance of difference, an amazing sense of human sensations, taste, smell, sight, hearing. You know, you taste that novel. If all your other senses were to blink out, you'd still experience that novel. You know, you could taste your way through Bleak House. Just a tremendous marvel of human imagination, you know. What a gift that just keeps giving.
London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. And it would not be wonderful to meet a medullosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire. Horses scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper, and losing their foothold at street corners, where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement, and accumulating at compound interest. Fog. Everywhere. Fog up the river, where it flows among green aits and meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping, and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes. Fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs. Fog lying out on the yards, and hovering in the rigging of great ships. Fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners, wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper, down in his close cabin. Fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck. Chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them, as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds.
That was the RNIB Talking Book version of Bleak House by Charles Dickens, as read by Morris Turner.
Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Well, I'd love to recommend a book by the poet and novelist Joe Dunthorne. It's called Children of Radium, and he goes in search of the story of his great-grandfather who worked as a chemist and had a certain position in Germany during the years when Germany was turning towards the darkness. And we don't know how involved he was. We certainly know he was a chemist whose experiments might have been used by the Nazis, but Joe has such a brilliant form of address, comical, self-knowing, wry, friendly, warm, that you just go with them on this journey and you know that round the next corner there might be a terrible revelation, but you still believe that you'd be on his side even so, and on his family's side, trying to deal with this terrifying time, this dark moment in history, which is somehow transmuted through Joe Dunthorne's wonderful literary personality. This is the guy who wrote Submarine, the novel, a few years ago, which was adapted for film, and he wrote a great volume of poems, O Positive. This is his latest book, so I really highly recommend it to everybody, The Children of Radium.
My grandmother grew up brushing her teeth with radioactive toothpaste. The active ingredient was irradiated calcium carbonate, and her father was the chemist in charge of making it. Even before it was available in shops, he brought tubes home to his family. Under the brand name Doramad, it promised gums charged with new life energy and a smile blindingly white. Their apartment was so close to the factory that she fell asleep listening to the churning of the autoclave. When they were forced to leave Germany in 1935, they took tubes of it with them, their suitcases gently emitting alpha particles as they travelled 1,000 miles east. During the war, she learned that the toothpaste her Jewish father helped create had become the preferred choice of the German army. A branch factory in occupied Czechoslovakia ensured that the troops pushing eastwards, brutalizing and murdering, burning entire villages to the ground, could do so with radiant teeth. Not that she ever told me this. What I knew about my grandmother's life had all come second-hand, anecdotes worn smooth with each retelling. When my mother gave me a ring for my wedding, she told me it had escaped the Nazis in 1935. I looked at the oval bloodstone, black with flecks of red, picturing their getaway with the unique clarity of someone untroubled by having done any research. It was my uncle who gave me a poster of the smiling, yellow-haired Doramad girl, glowing from the inside. I pinned it above my desk and began to write about my grandmother's childhood. The project was going well until an intervention from the person whose actual life it was.
Children of Radium, A Buried Inheritance by Joe Dunthorne, is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by the author.
Andrew O'Hagan, thank you very much.
What a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.